Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon. Dr. Stuart Kaufman, a theoretical biologist and a great deal more. Dr. Charles Raison, who is both a psychiatrist and a practicing scientist and a great deal more. I'm Paula Gordon. I'm simply blessed with this opportunity. Dr. Kaufman?
How come you're always so graceful,
Paula? You're doing this a lot.
Chuck, let me try to tell you why I think the mind is not algorithmic.
Please, I was going to add that.
Well, there's a method in my madness. Suppose that I'm right.
Okay.
First of all, it's going to turn out we don't have a theory of mind.
Yes.
Okay. And second of all, there may be an interesting tie to Buddhism that we can really make. And it's a unique opportunity for me to have you here for us to be talking to one another. So
would that be testable?
I don't know.
Well, let's hear the theory first.
Not everything is testable, I'm afraid. Okay, but maybe it is. I don't know. So let's talk first of all about what an algorithm is.
Yeah.
So an algorithm is an effective formal procedure. By formal, I mean mathematical.
Delivers a predictable result.
Carried out, for example, by a Turing machine or a computer, in which you put in some data in terms of some symbols, like ones and zeros, and then the machine cranks on them like a Turing machine does, and sometimes later it quits with an answer, or it goes on forever in the halting problem, and it doesn't halt for infinite time.
Right.
Okay, so that's what it is. Now, it'll take a few minutes to say this, Chuck, okay? There is, in cognitive science, something that's called the frame problem, okay? It is when you go into a restaurant, you get into the restaurant going into frame, and then there are some things you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go to a chair, you're supposed to sit down, you're supposed to pick up a menu. Okay. And there's some sort of, and this is the crux move, there's some sort of finitely pre-statable list of actions or if-then statements. If such and such is on the menu, then order it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But there's some finite pre-statable set of if-then statements or whatever that constitute the frame.
Yeah.
Now, out of that, then, if I can do that, then there's an effective procedure in which I can grind through it all and do whatever I'm supposed to do.
Would that be an algorithm?
That would be an algorithm. Yeah. Right. The way I'm going to try to battle that idea is to say that, in general, you can't get that finite set of statements. You can't get started, okay? And it'll take me a couple of minutes to say it.
Right.
And it will partially repeat what we've talked about before. So I have to tell you quickly what a Darwinian adaptation, then pre-adaptation is, and then the puzzle will arise. So to say it fast, if you were to ask Darwin, what's the function of the heart, he'd say pump blood. And then you'd say, but look, the heart makes heart sounds. And he'd say, but that's not the function of the heart. The heart was selected to pump blood. So that's what we both know.
Yeah,
that.
Right.
Okay. Now, you may or may not know the idea of a Darwinian pre-adaptation. You do. Okay.
Yeah.
So just to say it again so that we're for sure on the same page. His idea was that a property of part of you that is not useful in the current environment might turn out to be useful in some other environment.
Right.
And one case will suffice, given the shortness of time. The inner ear bone, the middle ear bones in you, the incus, stapes, and malleus and stapes, derive from the evolution of three adjacent bones in the jaw of some fish 400 or 500 million years ago.
Right. Which is one of our very, very early progenitors.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is one of our... So this is clearly Darwinian pre-adaptation, in which the first two claims that I'll make are easy. Did a new function come to exist in the biosphere? Yep, hearing. Did it affect the biosphere? Yep, new species, new proteins, all sorts of stuff. The critical question is the following. Do you think you could say ahead of time, all possible Darwinian pre-adaptations, say for all species alive now, or just for humans?
I don't think so.
Everybody thinks the same thing, Chuck. So there's a lot of consequences of what you just said. I'm going to tell you two reasons why I think you can't do it. Okay? Then I'm going to tell you that I don't know how to prove it. then I'm going to go flying off for a minute.
And then Chuck can talk.
This is a crux thing,
and it's worth struggling with.
Yeah.
I think a lot's at stake here, like several thousand years of Tibetan Buddhism, and it's tied to the West. So one reason I think you can't do it is I don't think you can list all possible selective environments. I mean, how would you get started on the task of listing all possible selective environments?
Yeah, that I think it's probably impossible. There might be essentially infinite selective environments across space and time. Yeah.
Now, Darwin tells
us that environment is deeply important.
Sure, mm-hmm. It's what.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Now, the next part of it is that relational properties matter in coevolution.
Yes.
Or in Darwinian pre-adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
In
and this coevolution,
case,
too.
And yeah. coevolution, yeah. Yeah. In this case, it's the fact that the three jawbones are adjacent to one another, and they wind up adjacent to one another in our middle ear. So the spatial arrangements matters to their emergence in the Darwinian...
What they can be, yeah, sure. What they can
I mean, if one had been in the spine, one had been in a fin, and one had been in the jaw...
That's not how we would hear
it. It probably wouldn't have evolved, right?
Right.
So that puts us in the following position, sort of with Leibniz, that we would have to list all relational properties of sort of everything to everything, and there's no way of doing that.
Okay.
How would we do it? Okay?
Yeah.
All right? Now, so one little more toy example that we talked about, Paula, Bill, and I before. Suppose I gave you a screwdriver and a hammer, a screwdriver and a nail and a piece of cloth. Can you tell me all the things that you could do with it?
I'll give you a hint. The short answer is no.
No.
Yeah.
And it might depend upon how far all of those things are from Fresno or from the wall.
Of course.
So somehow we can't list everything.
Right.
Okay. Now, I think that this is related to the frame problem. So let's just take it with screw and screwdriver. Let me stick with Darwinian pre-adaptations. I think this means a whole bunch of things. The first thing I think it means is the following, Chuck. The biosphere is evolving into what I will call the adjacent possible, sort of the next thing that can mm-hmm. happen.
But which comes out of chemistry, that whole concept.
Which comes out of chemistry and the kinds of molecules you can make next given what you got now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's definable. I don't think we can say what the adjacent possible is. That's what you just said we can't do. You just said no, okay?
Right.
Yet it happens, okay? Darwinian pre-adaptations are happening. I think the same thing may be happening in the mind, okay? In which, so I'll give you an example.
Okay.
Yeah, I will, because then I can get directly to the frame problem. I'm sorry if this is repeating a story, Paula. So some guys are trying to invent a tractor.
Yeah.
They have this huge engine block. They put it on a chassis, breaks the chassis. They keep making bigger and bigger and bigger chassis, keeps breaking them all. Finally, one of the engineers says, you know what, you could use the rigidity of the engine block and mount everything on the engine block itself and use it as a chassis.
Yeah.
That's a Darwinian pre-adaptation, right?
It's mm-hmm. also a tractor.
Yeah.
And it's a tractor.
Yeah.
I forgot to say tractor. Did I forget to say tractor?
It is a tractor.
That is how tractors are made.
Yeah.
So making a tractor made use of an unused causal property of the engine block, its rigidity, for a new function.
Yeah.
Okay? Okay. That's precisely the frame problem. The rigidity of the engine block isn't in... a pre-statable, it could be, but I mean it's not in the normal statable frame about the properties of an engine block, and therefore there's no deductive or algorithmic way to get to what the engineer did. Suppose you had a list of the properties of the engine block, but it didn't include the rigidity of the engine block.
Then you wouldn't know.
There would be no way to get to it, right? There would be no way to get to...
But yet in this example, somebody got to it.
Somebody did get
to it. Exactly.
Right.
So the problem becomes, and then I'll shut up and it's your turn, the problem becomes that there seems no way to state all the properties of things in themselves and relational properties of things that might turn out, for example, to be useful for something. Yet we do it all the time. So I conclude from this that we do things that cannot be done algorithmically because we cannot pre-state the set of possibilities. And to restate it, that's the frame problem. Okay?
Mm-hmm. So
this is why I think the mind is, this is one of the reasons I think the mind is not algorithmic.
So suppose eventually people developed a computer program that through any stated fact, let's say some evolutionary thing where they just let things run and it developed the ability to behave in the real world more like a being with, more like a living being. Would you then say that the computer was no longer algorithmic or that that's inherently impossible? Because it's not, or would you say that you've now developed a machine that's complex enough that it's tapping into quantum effects? Or because this is a sort of interesting question of I mean, it's true, we don't, I think this is why artificial intelligence has been so difficult, isn't it? Is that, that you have to finding a frame is very difficult. And yet, I look at what's been done in the last 15, 20 years, and I see, kind of rather remarkable process in terms
of
machines.
Yeah, there's language to do. Language. Pattern recognition.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Clearly, if that were to continue, created things would be able to behave like volitional beings that could make interesting decisions, not being able to answer or understand all the frames in which they're in. So how does that work?
Well, so one of the questions is can there be such machines?
That's right.
And my suspicion is that just maybe there can't be. Okay, I mean, obviously we've gotten really complicated computing machines. We just alluded to it and agreed to it. And besides, when we call the telephone company, we're experiencing one of them.
Okay? Yes.
So there's two directions one could go now. One is just asking whether or not the mind's algorithmic, and the second would be, and you mentioned it's quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
Quantum mechanics, the possibility that mind is quantum mechanical, isn't impossible. I've really now looked into it pretty thoroughly. Scientifically, it's pretty improbable.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just spend a moment on it. Okay.
Sort of my sense.
It turns out that chlorophyll, which is, captures sunlight for photosynthesis, is quantum coherent for about a nanosecond.
Oh.
And it's got a protein wrapped around it. Do you know about decoherence?
No, actually.
Okay. Do it for me.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the big puzzle in quantum mechanics is how you get from quantum possibilities captured in the Schrodinger wave and the Copenhagen interpretation to anything real ever happening. Because in quantum mechanics, nothing real ever happens on the Copenhagen interpretation. There are other interpretations. And the way it happens on the Copenhagen interpretation is the collapse of the wave function, when you measure something classically. The modern version of the collapse of the wave function is called decoherence, and the idea is that the phase information in the quantum waves essentially gets lost. It gets sort of lost out into the universe, and once it's lost, you can't get quantum interference again, so things become classical.
Yeah.
Okay? Crudely.
Yeah.
Okay? Anyway, having said that, there's now pretty good evidence that the chlorophyll molecule at body temperature, at room temperature, is quantum coherent, not for very long, but a nanoseconds long, if you're thinking on the Planck time scale of 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. And there's a protein around it called the antenna protein that is almost certainly suppressing decoherence, which means natural selection cared to preserve coherence, because somehow it's good for energy transport from the photon that comes in to activating the reaction center that then drives photosynthesis.
Yeah.
Okay, so that plus some theorems in quantum computing suggests that it's not impossible that something quantum mechanical could be going on. It's a long scientific step.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it should be taken with a pound of salt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not impossible. That's interesting because on the Copenhagen interpretation, you beat the problem of causal closure. Because in quantum mechanics, the quantum wave thing, the possibilities in the Schrodinger equation, are entirely acausal. Okay? They're just possibilities.
Right.
So there is no first cause because there's no cause at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so the whole problem of first cause that we were alluding to before simply disappears. Whether or not it helps with algorithmicity or not is an open question, because you can make quantum computers that are perfectly algorithmic.
Absolutely, that's right.
The flip side of it is you can have classical things like planets, and it's not obvious that they're computing an algorithm at all. They're going around
that's right. They're just,
the sun. They're doing their thing, right? So I'm not sure that cuts either way.
So just
to come back to the starting spot, Chuck, I think our mind is doing things that cannot, just like the biosphere is evolving in ways that cannot be pre-stated, but it's doing it anyway, without any consciousness, okay, 2 billion years ago, say, when presumably nothing was conscious, I think maybe the mind is doing things, going into an adjacent possible, seizing opportunities, like using the rigidity of the engine block for a purpose that cannot be calculated.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that there's no effective procedure to get to it because you couldn't state ahead of time all the relational properties. So I think we've got to embrace the possibility that the mind can be algorithmic. Obviously it can. We can do long division.
Yeah.
But maybe it's much deeper than that, and maybe the mind is non-algorithmic. And that would tie a whole new blasting weird thing that may be correct that is maybe going to hit Western science, because among other things, I'm trying to say it, when was Buddha? 2500 BC?
No, about 500 BC.
500. Well, okay, so that gives us 2500 years of history that would tie us to a Tibetan tradition that right now the computational model of the mind, which is very seductive, says, uh-uh, you Tibetans are wrong. Maybe they're not.
And with innovation possible in all kinds of parts of the universe, we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Stuart Coffman, Dr. Charles Raison, and before we leave, Chuck, you want to say?
No, we'll pick it up.
We'll pick it up when we come right back. Be with us.